fight to get home during the coronavirus pandemic. Barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn's family trip to Peru became a different kind of adventure when the country closed its borders. A story in 3 phone calls. And U.S. hospitals have a ventilator shortage. A team of Rice engineers say they have a solution. The device they've designed, Peter Holly reports, has piqued the interest of government officials and large manufacturers hoping to address the coronavirus crisis. Everything got ripped out from under us. How Texas's restaurant and bar workers are coping. Almost every segment of the American economy has been hurt by the coronavirus pandemic, but few have been hit as badly as those who serve meals and drinks. Patricia Sharp speaks with a bartender, a chef, and a restaurant executive about how the crisis is affecting them. And planting wildflowers in a pandemic. Perennials find a way to beat the odds, no matter how harsh the winter or how unrelenting the hurricane season. Whatever chaos this pandemic holds, Houston Poet Laureate Deborah D.E.P. Mouton says next year something beautiful will burst from the earth. We have this from the state. This is Traveling Outdoors. Guidebook by Pam LeBlanc, Going the Social Distance. It's not hard to find places across the state where you can commune with nature, if not one another. I travel Texas so much that when I wake up some mornings, it takes a few seconds for me to remember where I am. Camping in Big Bend, holed up in a cabin in the piney woods. But when the coronavirus pandemic hit the state in March, 6 upcoming spring trips were wiped from my calendar. Like most everyone else, I stayed home. As I found ways to exercise outside in Austin while sheltering in place, I discovered that adventure still awaits, no travel required. Just find a spot close by with room to roam. State parks are a great option if you live near one. At press time, many have remained open, although officials have closed visitor centers, as well as park headquarters and stores. An alert map on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website provides updated information. Depending on where you reside, you can paddle a river or whiz past wildflowers on your bike. Barring that, you can watch birds just about anywhere. To help you through this time of no travel, here are some suggestions for places to get in touch with Mother Nature while safely practicing social distancing. When the quarantine lifts, you can use this guide to help you explore the quiet corners of Texas. Near Austin, you can head to Roy G. Guerrero Colorado River Metro Park for some of the best birding in the city. More than 230 species have been spotted at the nearly 400-acre Riverside Park, including kingfishers, herons, hawks, egrets, ospreys, and recently, a visitor rarely seen in North America except for Alaska, called a white wagtail. The black and white bird, which apparently flew off course during migration, was spotted in February and March strolling the gravel bar below Longhorn Dam. Good thing about birds is they're really kind of all over the place, says Rich Kostecki, Director of Research and Planning at the Nature Conservancy in Texas. Even if you just go out into your backyard, you're likely to see some birds. Any day a new species could pop up as they start pushing north. Near Dallas, the Trinity River Audubon Center, which is 10 miles south of downtown Dallas, has been temporarily closed, but the AT&T Trail, which runs between that center and a trailhead at Elam Road, remains open. And it's 4.3 miles of prime birdwatching territory. The center itself was built on a former illegal dump site, now draws an array of hawks, owls, ducks, hummingbirds, finches, and buntings. If you're out by El Paso, the Tom Mays unit on the western slopes of the sprawling 27,000-acre Franklin Mountain State Park makes a fine gateway to the prickly expanse of desert surrounding the city. You can hike through canyons, soak up expansive views, and admire striking red rock landscapes. Rather explore on two wheels, head to the Chuck Heinrich Memorial Park access point on the east side of the Franklins for superb biking and slightly gentler slopes. Our trails are, relatively speaking, underutilized, says Don Baumgart, who in normal times leads guided trips in the area as a volunteer. There are more than 100 miles of trails in the park, so people are not going to have a problem social distancing. Here in Houston, you can take your kayak or canoe to Carmon Bayou Nature Center in Pasadena, where you can drop a boat into a cool green oasis of water fringed with elephant's ear and cypress trees. Keep an eye out for alligators. Remember that the depth changes depending on the tide. It's a favorite training ground for local endurance canoe racers like Joel Truitt, a former brewer at San Arnold Brewing Company, spends hours exploring the bayou and adjacent Mud Lake and Clear Lake. If you'd prefer to stay on land, hop onto the Buffalo Bayou Trail System, which when complete will provide 20 miles of paved and gravel trail linking a series of parks to downtown. Although visitor centers, play areas, and the dog park are closed for now, the trail itself remains open, You can find what feel like remote areas in the middle of downtown Houston, Truett says. Now by San Antonio, equestrians and trail runners have room to ramble at Hill Country State Natural Area near Bandera, where creek bottoms and rugged canyons crisscross more than 5,000 acres of lush meadows and yucca and prickly pear dotted terrain. Louise Merrick deeded her old ranch to the state in the 70s, attracting visitors who come with their four-hoofed friends to explore 40 miles of equestrian trails. If you don't have a horse, mountain bikes and hiking boots are welcome too. Downtown, you can hop on a bicycle to explore the Mission Trail's hike and bike route, which links a string of Spanish colonial missions. But instead of starting at the Alamo, begin at Mission Concepcion and pedal south toward the river. 8-mile trail connects the Concepcion, San Jose, San Juan, and Espada missions, as well as a grist mill and a 270-year-old irrigation system with a dam and aqueduct. In Central Texas, now's the time to get in on the gravel riding boom. The bicycles, which are beefier than a road bike but lighter than a mountain bike, can handle rural gravel roads where cyclists don't have to worry so much about cars whizzing past at high speeds. Sure, you'll have to deal with sand and washboard stretches of country roads, but that's what makes it fun. The gravel roads around Castell, just west of Llano, are home to the annual Castell Grind, the biggest organized gravel ride in the state, delayed this year from April until October. Is road cycling more your thing? Pedal the Willow City Loop near Fredericksburg for an up-close view of spring wildflowers. Park in Willow City, which is basically a bar called Harry's on the Loop, temporarily closed, a historic school and a herd of goats. Then ride west until you reach Texas Highway 16. Turn right, blast down the big hill, and hang another ride onto the Willow City Loop. Now comes the real fun, cruising along a two-lane highway that weaves among craggy boulders, crosses a few creeks, and winds past pastures of Indian blankets, wine cups, blue bonnets, and poppies. Just prepare for the giant hill at the end of the 21-mile route, and note that the land alongside the road is private. Down by the Gulf Coast, I could spend days walking portions of the 70-mile stretch of beach at Padre Island National Seashore in Corpus Christi, nesting grounds for Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, and home to some 380 species of birds where I always break to run into the surf every now and then. Visitor center is closed, but beach access is open for day use from the end of Park Road 22 all the way south to Mansfield Channel. It's 60 miles to spread out, folks. Or head to the Port O'Connor Paddling Trail, part of a statewide network of paddling routes where you can explore the back bays of Matagorda Island, watching cranes wade on spindly legs and pelicans flap overhead. Put your boat in the water at the end of the 16th Street and paddle across the channel, watch out for barges, into a twisty network of bayous and pathways through the marshes along the edge of Espiritu Santo Bay and Siluria Bayou. In North Texas, if water's your thing, it is mine, plan a day at Possum Kingdom Lake, located 90 miles west of Fort Worth. Possum Kingdom State Park is open, and there you'll find a series of dreamy cliff-lined inlets where you can float or swim laps on a warm day. Best part, the clarity of the water. Stare into the blue long enough and you'll see a bass or crappie glide past. South Texas, I once spent a day admiring green jays and chachalacas at Benson Rio Grande Valley State Park, the headquarters of the World Birding Center and Mission. With the help of a guide, I spotted a burrowing owl tucked into a row of onions in a nearby field outside the park's boundaries. In all, about 360 bird species have been sighted in the palm-lined resacas and riverside woodlands of the Birding Center and network of 9 birding sites, including Benson, along a 120-mile stretch of the River Road. As of this writing, several of the other sites, including the South Padre Island Birding and Nature Center, are temporarily closed. And out in West Texas, it's too remote for most of us until it's safe to travel again, but Big Bend Ranch State Park is one of my favorite secluded spots. It's not hard to lose yourself among a lunar landscape of prickly plants and rambling rocky trails, perfect for mountain biking. You might launch yourself into a cactus or clatter over a hill of glistening white crystal rocks, and you'll probably walk away with scratches and stab wounds, but those will quickly fade. Access the park's best single-track trails from the trailhead across the road from the Barton Warnock Visitor Center just west of Terlingua. Pam LeBlanc, who wrote this, is an Austin-based journalist who specializes in outdoor adventure and recreation. Turning now to one of our feature articles in this month's edition of Texas Monthly, we have this item called Crankiest Writer in Utopia. When I agreed to write a profile of the best-selling author, Paulette Giles, I figured it would be a straightforward assignment. read her books, interview her, talk with some of her admiring friends and colleagues, and turn in a well-rounded portrait of one of Texas's most beloved novelists. And then I asked the wrong question. This is by Emily McCullough. This was the first time I was interviewed about a new book by somebody who hated writing and didn't read books until recently. Paulette Giles wrote me via email on January 30th. She was responding to my request to ask her a few follow-up questions, and this was her characteristically caustic way of saying no. Before she signed off, "Sorry about that, but it just isn't working for me." She also let me know she'd read some of my work online and had come away less than impressed. It's not my first experience being insulted by the best-selling author of Western novels. 2 weeks earlier, when we spent almost 3 hours together on her 31-acre spread in the unincorporated hill country town of Utopia, she'd sneaked in a few barbs. There was one, "Shame on you," when I admitted to not being as well-versed in the works of Charles Dickens as I probably ought to be. Then there was the way she asked me, sharply, if I was capable of understanding the big difference between those who listen to music and those who make music. It was not a consumer culture, she said of her childhood in the Missouri Ozarks. It was a culture that produced. But Giles had also been hospitable and welcoming. 76-year-old novelist who stands no taller than 5'2" and walks with quick steps and a forward slant, as if she'll save time by getting the top half of her body to its destination sooner, met me on the steps of Utopia's Lost Maples Cafe so I wouldn't get lost, winding my way up the dirt road leading to her house at the top of a limestone ridge. Made me a cup of coffee as soon as we arrived at her home, using a plastic pour-over and an old Stanley thermos like some makeshift country Chemex. Toward the end of our interview, she insisted on feeding me lunch, crackers, cheese, and cold cuts, and when I finished all the ham on my plate, she got up and sliced more without even asking if I wanted some. I knew she hadn't liked it when I asked if I could interview the friends she rides horses with and the members of her bluegrass band, Picking on the Porch. "You're free to do whatever you like, but I find that very disturbing," she said. And I knew I full-on picked her off with a question about her romantic life in the years before she met the man she eventually married. "Why is any of that any of your business?" she asked. "I guess it isn't," I replied, choosing not to remind her that she'd already published 2 memoirs and mentioned that very subject. It was that second offending inquiry that prompted her soon after to cut off all further contact with me. At least, in having been spurned by Paulette Giles, I find myself in good company. I've been warned by more than one person that she was, quote, prickly. There were reports of her castigating fans at book readings when they asked questions she didn't think were intelligent enough. Her blog, where she frequently posts personal and professional updates, makes clear that she disapproves of all kinds of things. Young people, Kindles, political correctness, Europe's decision to admit large numbers of Middle Eastern refugees, the best-selling thriller Gone Girl, cancel culture and other manifestations of modern liberalism, the graphics for the video game Minecraft, best-selling thriller The Girl on the Train, and an acquaintance who once sent her an email that made fun of Melania Trump's shoes while Giles was helping out with Hurricane Harvey relief efforts. And there was her tendency to publicly disparage the work of her peers, including that of other Texas writers who set novels in 19th century American West, such as Philip Meyer's celebrated novel, The Sun, which she scoffed at on her blog, and Elizabeth Crook's The Which Way Tree, which she panned in the pages of the New York Times Book Review. She had nearly identical complaints about both books, claiming they featured protagonists who didn't possess, quote, agency. Over the course of our time together, Giles took pot shots at all sorts of things. She condemned the writing professors for teaching the next generation to value self-expression over plot structure. Pooh-poohed the many contemporary authors who, like Meyer and Crook, center books around characters to whom things happen and not assertive protagonists with inner drive. She complained multiple times about television, an appliance she does not own, telling me the lighted screen is a narcotic. The tension in the air was pronounced, set against the peacefulness of our surroundings. Giles lives alone in a hill country dreamscape, a light-filled cabin perched on a ridge near the Savinal River, a cypress-lined waterway that nature writer John Graves once referred to as possibly the purest Texas river of all. The town is named Utopia for a reason. Giles's professional life seemed equally charmed. She has sold more than 800,000 books in North America, and her novels aren't popular just with the public. Critics love her too, placing Giles alongside Cormac McCarthy and Larry McMurtry as a modern master of the Western. She's been lauded for the poetic efficiency of her prose and for her captivating characters who are inspiring in their steadfastness. Her previous book, 2016's News of the World, was a finalist for the National Book Award and is currently being made into a movie starring the Tom Hanks. Her latest novel, Simon the Fiddler, which came out April 14th, has already received starred reviews from Kirkus and Booklist. Sort of life countless MFA students take out massive loans in the vain hopes of someday attaining. So why is Paulette Giles so cranky? Giles has, on occasion, been a woman of confrontation, but the targets of her rancor have changed over the years. In fact, Giles, current castigator of political correctness and cancel culture, used to be an anti-war protester. But she had an eccentric take on the fight for peace, putting perhaps more emphasis on the fight than on the peace. At one demonstration at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where she was studying Romance languages, she threw a rock at a police officer with every ounce of strength she could muster and instead hit a fellow protester in the head. She then pretended that the projectile had been lobbed by one of the nearby rednecks. This earlier version of Giles seems to embarrass her latter-day successor. When she described this incident in her 1992 memoir, Cousins, she appeared mortified by her attitude at the time. It was pure D arrogance, she wrote of her belief that her creativity and intelligence somehow made her better than her peers who were being sent overseas to fight. Giles, who was born in 1943 in the small town of Salem, Missouri, dismissively categorizes the first few decades of her adult life as that of a hippy-dippy poet. 1968, following a trail taken at the time by many counterculture types, she accompanied her pacifist artist boyfriend to Canada, where he moved to avoid the draft. By the time they broke up a few years later, she was producing radio documentaries for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation while working on her poetry, so she stayed in her new adopted nation. 1973, soon after Giles published her first poetry collection, the CBC relocated her from Toronto to a tribal reservation in far northern Ontario, a remote area where she helped the Cree and Ojibwe communities set up local stations that would broadcast in their native tongues. It was a transformational experience for Giles, who says the experience of living on a reservation made her feel stronger and more confident than she ever had before. It also changed her as a poet and a storyteller. Tribes' myths and oral traditions inspired her to think more deeply about humanity's ancient need for narrative. In North Spirit, her 1995 memoir about this period, Giles described this, perhaps a bit opaquely, as our perilous, dangerous gift of image hypnosis, which takes us into strange territory. The storyteller, she wrote, was the guide, tasked with leading the listener and presumably the reader through an imagined land of peril and adventure. In the early 80s, after a decade with the tribes, she moved back to southern Canada and published her second poetry collection, which in 1985 earned her the country's prestigious Governor General's Award. More poems followed, and with them came additional acclaim. And then in 1989, Giles met the man who would become her husband and never published a new poem. 1989, Giles was camping with a cousin in southern Missouri when the two women happened to pitch their tent next to that of a retired Army colonel named Jim Johnson. A conservative Texan who was trapped in an unhappy second marriage came over one night to help them light a fire. Giles would later write that Johnson, surrounded by wood smoke, looked like, quote, a cowboy demon. Once they got to talking, it wasn't long before they got to flirting, and they stayed up until dawn arguing about the Vietnam War, sharing stories from their lives, and making each other laugh. Giles was attracted to Johnson's amiable kind of courtesy and the fact that he had taken big risks in his life. He'd been involved in large events, from Brownsville, Germany, to Saigon, a cattle ranching in Oklahoma, she would later write, of the South Texas native who had spent several decades in the Army. Just before the sun rose, Johnson told Giles he'd, quote, been waiting for a long time for somebody to talk to. In many ways, meeting Johnson initiated a dramatic transformation in Giles' life, both personally and professionally. She was already fed up with my life just being poems, she later wrote. poems and a sort of mild bohemian poverty that comes from not working much and not going anywhere outside of books. So she turned her attention to a different genre, the memoir. For Cousins, her first foray into long-form nonfiction prose, Giles and Johnson, who was now separated from his wife, spent 7 months traveling by trailer through the southern and midwestern United States, tracking down and interviewing some of her 24 first cousins. Giles was motivated in part by the desire to fill in some blanks about her late father, a man she remembers as being in an almost perpetual rage during her childhood. Giles' father had made appearances in her writing before. An early poem of hers opens with the lines, "My father was an alcoholic when all he said he wanted to be was a member of the Elks Club." But a memoirist must be even more forthcoming about her life than a poet. She can't hide behind ambiguity. And though Giles doesn't actually spend that many pages on her father, Cousins offers a clear picture of her own personality. It's a forthrightly blemished self-portrait, though in its pages, Giles often steps away from doing the crucial work of trying to find out why she is the way she is. She vividly describes herself as quarrelsome and insecure, and then waves her hand at the subject. "I don't know what makes me rocket off sometimes," she writes in an early chapter, and she leaves it at that. She admits that she can be dishonest. Not long after she and Johnson met, she sent him another writer's poetry and passed it off as her own because she was self-conscious about her work. She is full of contradictions, too, and she doesn't always acknowledge them. "I am not ready to meet all your family," she shouts at the man she'd invited on a month-long expedition to meet hers. By the time Cousins came out in 1992, Giles and Johnson were married and living in San Antonio, where Johnson had spent time as a young Army lieutenant. Giles was soon smitten with the town. The couple bought an 1890s home in a King William historic district, which they restored themselves. He spent time in Germany, where one of Johnson's sons lived, to care for Johnson's grandchildren when his son and daughter-in-law, who were both in the Army, were sent on tours of duty. "I was 50 years old, I'd never had children, and all of a sudden I've got a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old in diapers," she told me. "It was wonderful." Later, when the children visited the San Antonio house, Giles would turn off all the lights and lead them around by candlelight, making up tales about the historic home's previous inhabitants. "The storyteller is deeply part of who she is," says Faith Johnson Lowry, Giles's now grown granddaughter, who still calls her Granty. Johnson was financially independent, which gave Giles enough slack to devote herself to creative pursuits. Separated from the Canadian literary community she'd been a part of for years, she became friends with local writers like the poet Naomi Shihab Nye. "She was terrific," remembers Nye. "It was so fun to walk through the streets with her because she always knew more than anyone else did about the history, the essences." Around this time, Giles began a process that would usher in the next big transformation of her career. She was researching a novel. Giles, who has always been captivated by her family's history, had grown obsessed with the mystery surrounding her great-great-grandfather, Marquis Giles, justice of the peace in southeastern Missouri, who disappeared from the public record during the Civil War. While digging into her family's genealogy during a visit back home in the mid-90s, Giles came across a historical detail she was shocked she hadn't learned in school. Missouri, she knew, was a slave state that never officially seceded. What she hadn't known was that the Union militia often imprisoned Missouri women who were suspected of aiding rebels. She seized on this detail, recognizing that it could be the foundation for a big, fat, full-length novel. That she'd never written a novel before hardly seemed relevant. "I'm going to try it," she told herself. And try she did, though it took her 7 years to finish the project. "A novel is a 2-year commitment," Giles says, "but Enemy Women took longer because my life wasn't entirely my own then. It was a historic house to remodel, grandkids to care for, and a husband whose plans, wants, and needs she had to consider. She also had to teach herself how to construct a plot. As a poet, she had been required to hold a reader's attention for hundreds of pages at a time. As a memoirist, she took her narrative cues from actual events. Now she had to create an entire narrative from the ground up, and that wasn't a problem any research trip to Missouri could solve. A lot of people think, oh, if I throw in more historical details, it'll make this book work. And it doesn't, says Giles. If you don't have a character with inner drive, then you're going to have serious plot problems. Adair Colley, the protagonist of Enemy Women, has no shortage of inner drive. She's a tomboyish spitfire who has a seemingly constitutional inability to suffer fools. novel's entire narrative is propelled by Adair's unwavering desire to escape from a Union prison and reunite her war-torn family and save their Ozark Mountain home. There are external forces at play, sure, like the bloodiest war in American history and the inherent untrustworthiness of other people. But Adair never sees herself as a victim. She talks back, she fights, and she takes what's hers. Giles was similarly goal-focused once she had the completed manuscript in hand. She was certain about the quality of her work. I never lose confidence in my books, she says. I don't have to ask anybody for their approval. Not everyone agreed. Giles says that Enemy Women was rejected by as many as 15 publishers. I knew the book was good, she said, but the rejection was depressing. Giles wanted to stop sending it out, but her agent decided to try one more house, HarperCollins imprint, William Morrow, which bought the book and pays Giles what she refers to as a, quote, big advance. The investment was wise. Enemy Women was published in 2002 on a wave of critical endorsement. Publishers Weekly said it was sure to be touted as a new Cold Mountain, another best-selling Civil War odyssey. The New York Times published not one but two favorable reviews. Book clubs across the country were drawn to Giles' debut, including a group of women in New Jersey who recommended the novel on Good Morning America's Read This segment. Readers were charmed by the book's spirited protagonist, a rare heroine in a genre that usually prioritizes the stories of white-headed men. One fan described Adair as, quote, a vast relief, who exhibited no sentiment, no whining, no mawkish plucking of our heartstrings. Yes. In a San Antonio Express News article, Giles suggested she wouldn't let the book's success go to her head. I just hope my life continues to be dull and plodding, she said. It's the best thing for me. But her life did change, profoundly. By 2003, her and Johnson's different approaches to life had caught up with them. Johnson was a city person, outgoing and highly social. Giles wanted a quieter life, more isolation, more time that she could spend alone with her imagination and a notebook. So they divorced amicably. Johnson kept the King William House, and Giles used some of her newfound wealth to buy the Utopia property. Giles would speak favorably of Johnson for years after their split. Marrying this person was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, other than writing Enemy Women, she wrote in a 2015 blog post. The fact that he is now an ex is beside the point. Johnson passed away a year after that, 2016. The 31 acres on that limestone ridge came with an old hunter's cabin, which Giles fixed up to her liking, replacing the previous owner's beer signs and mounted deer heads with family photos and full bookcases. Turned the attic into a small office, complete with a desktop computer for writing and accessing the internet. She bought a couple of horses and cleared cedar and mountain laurel from a pasture to give them space to run. She made friends with some locals, including a group of women she rode horses and traveled with, and she sang in a choir at a nearby church. She taught herself to play the Irish tin whistle and joined up with a local bluegrass band. But mostly, she wrote, and now that her life was her own again, the books were quicker to finish than Enemy Women had been. The same intensity that had long driven her to rocket off seemed to have found its ideal release. Her second novel, Stormy Weather, about a young woman struggling to keep her family afloat in Depression-era Texas, came out in 2007 and earned her another spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Her third novel, the thrilling and heartrending The Color of Lightning, based on the true story of freedman Britt Johnson, who rescued his wife and children after they were captured by a band of Kiowa and Comanche raiders, followed 2 years later. Taking a break here real quick to remind you that we are listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, or streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listen at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. And now back to our text. A few years after that, Giles tried her hand at dystopian science fiction, releasing Lighthouse Island in 2013. I like a challenge, she says. Science fiction, you have to invent everything, coinage, transportation, communication, social levels, without falling into cliches. The book's protagonist was by now a familiar figure in Giles's work, a plucky, no-nonsense young woman, in this case, one who would stop at nothing to reach the utopian community she'd seen in an advertisement. In 2016's News of the World, Giles returned to the 19th century, picking up the thread of Army veteran Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd, a minor character from The Color of Lightning, as he escorts a young orphan recovered from Kiowa captivity back to her relatives near San Antonio. It was short, clocking in at just over 200 pages, but it packed a big punch, earning spots on several Best of 2016 lists. The novel was a simple but poignant journey narrative, vivid descriptions of landscape and community that transported readers to an 1870s Texas that felt real and alive. It was, deservedly, named a finalist for the National Book Award. Also caught the eye of Tom Hanks, who Matt snatched up the movie rights with an eye toward playing Jefferson. When that book tour was over, Giles went back to two minor characters from News of the World, Simon Bowdlin and Doris Dillon, for her new novel, Simon the Fiddler. Yet another Giles Western, filled with rich attention to historical detail, gripping action, luscious prose, and a determined protagonist who doesn't really care what anyone thinks of him. And that's been Giles' life for almost 17 years. She wakes up, makes her coffee, walks down the hill to feed the horses, practices the tin whistle, reads and writes. If she has her main character nailed down, Giles says, the writing comes easily enough. If the character is not so solidified, then I have to do a lot of walking around and thinking. Her literary friends in San Antonio had been sad to see her go, but they understood. To live in such a solitary circumstance is a very brave act, poet Naomi Shihab Nye told me. It's not something that most writers would be able to do. I just think the way she has chosen to live served her art, and she knew that. She had that instinct. That's what she needed to do. You have to love solitude, or you're not going to be a writer, Giles told me not long before she replenished my ham. Indeed, the hermetic genius is a stereotype not unfamiliar in the literary world. The most celebrated ones seem to be men, J.D. Salinger, Cormac McCarthy, and Thomas Pynchon, to name a few, though Emily Dickinson and Harper Lee are also on the list. Lee didn't have a blog, and Giles does. This has its upsides and its downsides. On the one hand, Giles keeps her many fans informed about her day-to-day. She writes about the horseback riding trips she takes with her group of girlfriends. She posts updates on the book she's working on and literary events she attends. She dwells on the things she loves, her horses, her cats, her bluegrass band, science fiction novels, and the works of Charles Dickens, whom she admires for the assertiveness of his characters. These posts are often charming, even sweet. On the other hand, there are parts of her blog that read like the comment section of a USA Today article about how young people don't frequent state fairs anymore. She makes broad generalizations about large swaths of people, like millennials, who apparently spent too much time in her youth watching TV and thus weren't properly socialized. She contradicts herself on occasion, as when she disdains people who consume music but don't produce it, and then writes an entry that mentions how much she appreciates her bluegrass band's audience. And despite her stated disapproval of the narcotic lighted screen, she seems happy to pass the time watching films and videos on her computer, such as her favorite science fiction shorts on YouTube. Last year, Giles was so entertained by the trailer for the 2017 film The Death of Stalin that she felt compelled to write a blog post recommending that her readers stream the movie, which she hadn't actually seen. And she turned even that recommendation into a fight of sorts, making a point of saying that The Death of Stalin had bombed at the box office, which it hadn't. It was as if she could speak favorably about a work of art only if she was expressing disagreement with a large group of people who supposedly didn't like it. After receiving the email when she announced that she would no longer speak to me, I had expected to show up on her blog eventually, and on February 25th I did. The post, which was titled 3,000 Book Plates to Sign and an Intrusive Interviewer, covered a number of subjects and referred to me as someone with whom I never should have spoken. It's odd to have the woman you're profiling write about you before you've had a chance to publish your story, but that's the risk you run when you write about a writer. And, of course, anyone who values their privacy as much as Giles does, that is, when she's not writing memoirs or blog posts, is going to be wary of media attention. Still, though the blog post itself was relatively anodyne, the cruel tone of the email she had sent me seemed excessive. But if Giles' acid comments about me were momentarily wounding, they were also revealing. Her characterization of me as somebody who hated writing and didn't read books until recently was a gross caricature of two things that I had told her. that I, like countless writers, often lack confidence in my own work, and that, under the influence of Netflix and HBO Go, I had all but stopped reading books for a couple years before Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan novels reignited my love of literature. In order to justify her decision to ghost me, Paulette Giles had weaponized my own vulnerability in a blatantly false manner. It was sort of baffling that the pitiless critic of canceled culture had canceled me, that the scold of Snowflakes was so unsettled by a single question of mine that she could no longer bear to respond to my emails. But then again, Giles, in her memoirs and in her blog posts, has long seemed uninterested in probing her own motivations and self-contradictions, a reluctance that shows up in her fiction, too. Witnessing one of those moments when Giles couldn't help but rocket off made me think about the protagonists of her novels, who often do the same. Simon Bowden, the titular character of Simon the Fiddler, is perhaps Giles's angriest to date. Simon had a hair-trigger temper, and he knew it, writes Giles in the first chapter of the book. He's not always mad. He has a great capacity for kindness. One could easily imagine him serving generous helpings of ham to a guest, but he's vulnerable and easily frustrated, and he lashes out at those around him. During the last days of the Civil War, Simon throws a fist-sized rock at the head of a Yankee soldier who had stolen his prized fiddle, an echo, perhaps, of Giles' experience as a college protester. When the wounded Yankee sits on the ground, Simon proceeds to kick him in the head. Reading these passages, you might expect that at some point Giles would ask and at least tentatively answer the question, what makes Simon so angry? But she doesn't. She gives him some backstory. He was born out of wedlock to a woman who died when he was a child, but she seems otherwise incurious about his psychology. The same goes for the love story at the heart of the book. Simon falls hard and fast when he spots the beautiful Irish governess Doris Dillon across the hall at a banquet, and he decides immediately that she should be his wife. He knows it's love, and Giles doesn't question it either. She spends almost no time investigating why Simon's feelings for Doris are so immediate and so strong, or whether we should regard such love at first sight with skepticism. It matters not why he feels, only that he does. Plots need to be surprising, exciting, Giles told me. There's no time for slowing down and peeking behind a curtain. Other authors, she has written, give their characters too much hesitancy, refusal of the quest, dithering, wondering, internal monologues, flashbacks to childhood, emotional scenes, etc., which Giles believes is proof that the writer had not thought out his or her plot. Of course, many writers give their characters full-bodied interior lives because they're trying to offer their readers more than a rollicking good time. At moments, Giles acknowledges that there's an entire realm of literature that's not primarily concerned with narrative events. Going back 1,000 years or more, she told me, there have been two streams of storytelling. There's the heady stuff about the human condition, which tends to fall on the side of poetry, personal expression, feelings, observations. In that category, Giles includes the 11th century Japanese classic, The Tale of Genji. On the other end of the spectrum is the very ancient stream in which Giles herself feels most comfortable, the plot-driven epic, like Homer's The Odyssey. Both streams, Giles assures me, are valuable. I think the human mind needs both, she said. It's our nature. Yet again and again, in interviews and blog entries, she declares her disdain for all but the plot-heavy epics. Characters who hesitate or who are victims of their circumstances aren't as good as the kinds of characters who don't think, do. It's a version of that inner drive that Giles speaks of so often but seems uninterested in examining. Skepticism, introspection, self-doubt, one almost feels Giles' eyes narrowing at the mere mention of such words. Instead, she gives all of her protagonists obstacles. External ones, not internal ones, that can only be overcome, not contemplated. Standing between Simon and his desire for a peaceful life of love and music are danger, violence, imprisonment, bad guys, disease. That's a great theme, to have a creative artist struggling in the midst of chaos, social chaos, and absolutely determined not to get turned aside, no matter how poor he gets or how hungry, Giles told me. Needless to say, that's not the world that Paulette Giles, sitting at her computer on her picturesque 31-acre ranchette, writing novels that are beloved by hundreds of thousands of readers, lives in. But picking fights with fellow authors, college students, and nosy journalists? That's a pretty good way to create a world for oneself that, for a moment, might feel as exciting as living under the threat of the Comanche. Who has time to hesitate, zither, engage in internal monologues, or refuse the quest. All right, these next couple items come from another one of our feature articles in this month's edition. This part is the article is The Great Texas Fishing Safari. Texas offers some of the most diverse fishing in the country, from stalking monster sharks on Padre Island to fly fishing from a kayak on a remote Pecos River. And for 3 months, I got to try it all. This is by Wes Ferguson. And one of these little things here we're going to do is a little sidebar called Starter Kit, Kayak Fishing 101. Four essential items for paddling your way to the catch. So, you're ready to plunge deeper into fishing. Maybe your hometown lake is calling your name, or you're an adventurous sort who wants to paddle a remote river like the Pecos or the Natchez. Enter kayak fishing. Beautiful marriage of two fun outdoor pursuits, angling and paddling. Kayak fishing has exploded in popularity in recent years, and no wonder. It's easy on the environment, helps you stay in shape while exploring the state's beautiful waterways, and is relatively affordable. Here's the gear you'll need to get off dry land and into a yak. First of all, obviously, is a kayak. Fishing kayaks are usually wider than touring or whitewater yaks because width generally equals stability. You don't want to accidentally tip over when you're reeling in the big one, do you? On ponds and lakes, consider paying more for a pedal drive kayak, which you propel with your feet, kind of like riding a bicycle. That way, says Austin-based kayak angling expert Steve Penn, you're using your hands to fish. There's one big downturn to wide kayaks. They can be difficult to maneuver. A short yak of 10 or 12 feet can help you dodge obstacles in swift and shallow streams. You might also want to kit out your boat with rod holders, a fish finder, and dry bag to keep your stuff from getting wet. Oh, and an anchor will keep you from drifting away when the fish are biting. A paddle expert at your local kayak shop can help you calculate the right paddle length, which depends on your height and the width of your kayak. Err on the side of too long, a short paddle will hit the sides of your boat. And a life vest, or a personal flotation device, or PFD, that fits snugly but isn't too bulky, allows a wide range of motion and has a thin back, important for comfort when you're sitting in your seat for all-day fishing sessions. Skip the newfangled inflatable PFDs. Too much maintenance, Penn says. And eyewear. Polarized lenses do more than protect your eyes from harmful UV rays. They also cut the reflective glare on the surface of the water so you can see the fish before you cast. Consider a floaty that will keep your glasses from sinking to the bottom when they inevitably fall off. The nicer they are, the quicker they sink, says Baron Boyette of Gordy & Sons Outfitters in Houston. Now, some of the other sidebars from this same article. These are different kinds of lures, and they're under the sidebar, all the titles the same. Lures we love. The first up is the Vibra Wedge. The company is Stanley Jigs. You can find them on the web at fishstanley.com. They're located in Huntington, Texas. Their application is a spinnerbait for bass. Costs $8.39. Lonnie Stanley is in the Texas Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame for his exploits with a rod and reel, as well as for his novel lures. The East Texan was the first to hand-tie jig skirts off tentacles to give lures a lifelike appearance. His hard-thumping Vibra Wedge spinnerbaits have been responsible for countless tournament wins, including native Texan Rick Klund's U.S. Open win on Lake Mead, where he rigged the Vibra Wedge with a translucent skirt cool finicky bass. The pros demanded something like this, said Stanley, who started the company in 1979 while working as a heavy equipment operator in College Station. With all of the great lakes here, like Rayburn, Toledo, Bend, Conroe, and Livingston, this area produced so many pros and so many innovations. Another one of the lures we love of the Great Texas Fishing Safari is a trailer hitch jig. Company is Oldham Jigs, or on the internet at oldhamjigs.com. Located in Wimberley, Texas, and their application is a jig for bass. Costs $2.85. Terry Oldham may call the hill country town of Wimberley home, but his lures are revered on the giant binational border lakes Falcon and Amistad, as well as on Mexican reservoirs like Sugar Lake and Comadero. because they stand up to the toughest beatings of bass can dish out. Oldham builds spinnerbaits and jigs that are meant to snake their way through and over the thickest of cover, from submerged Wasatch and mesquite trees to craggy rocks and bluffs. The trailer hitch comes with beefed up components, including a custom hook that looks more like a shark gaff than something you'd use for run-of-the-mill bass fishing. Another one is the Mad Dog 130. The company is Sixth Sense Fishing Products. That's 6THSENSEFishing.com on the web. Located in Willis, Texas, the application at the topwater lure for bass, redfish, and speckled trout. Price from $9.99 to $10.99. Casey Sobchak started painting lures in his dorm at Stephen F. Austin State University. After college, he turned his hobby into an industry-leading business. Had an older brother working in oil fields, and he lent me some money and later became my business partner, Sobchak says. His lures are all money, but it's the hard baits with their unusual details and precision paint jobs that catch the most attention, along with lots of fish. Mad Dog walks from side to side easily and has a loud rattle to call fish from long distances. A lot of companies were making two or four very basic color schemes, he said. We wanted to provide more of a custom look with 3D colors, 3D eyes, and other details that set us apart. We've got another one here. Another one of the lures we love. This is the Lunch Money. Company is Fly Geek Custom Flies. Flygeek.net. That's FlyGeek.net. Located in Austin, Texas. The application is using for as a streamer fly for Guadalupe bass, redfish, and rainbow trout. $19.95 for a pack of three. Matt Bennett began fly fishing at his family's cabin in Colorado, but it wasn't until he moved to Austin that he got serious about tying his own flies. Once I started fishing in the hill country, he says, where our rivers and streams are pretty clear, I wanted something that looked like the bait fish species that we have. So he came up with the Lunch Money, using rabbit fur strips and silicon legs. Though Bennett developed his signature streamer specifically for our state fish, the Guadalupe bass, he says, it works really well for redfish down on the coast and pretty well for the trout in the Guadalupe. Another one here is the Senko, and this is lures we love. The company is Gary Yamamoto Custom Baits on the internet at baits.com. The offices are in Arizona. Application, it's a soft plastic worm for bass. Price is $7 to $8 per pack of 5 to 10. Gary Yamamoto's Senko isn't just a productive lure. It's a game changer. Lauded for its simplicity, natural tail action, and slow sink, the Senko was first developed by Yamamoto in the 90s after considerable trial and error. It has since helped catch countless bass all over the world. Many anglers turn to the Senko as their confidence lure. They tie it on when nothing else is working. The lure, which works best in shallow water, remains top of market. A few years ago, we did a study and found there's like 58 companies that have a knockoff on the bait, says Ron Colby, Yamamoto's vice president of operations. But we still grow every year. Another of the lures we love from the Great Fishing Safari here is Paul Brown's original. Company is Miro Lure, and the internet URL is shopmirolure.com. That's shopmirolure.com. Located in Florida. Application is topwater plug for speckled trout. Costs from $8 to $11. Paul Brown is 85, and it's a name familiar to many Texas saltwater anglers. His original Corky lure, a soft plastic twitch bait named for its cork core, has been popular with trout catchers since it came on the market in the 70s. For decades, Brown made and sold lures from his Houston garage, expanding on the original Corky with the Fat Boy and the Devil, which were slight modifications on shape and size. The Fat Boy is, as you can imagine, fatter than the original Corky, and the Devil has an elongated tail. Brown sold his business to Florida-based company Miro Lure in 2010 which still designs and manufactures the original, the Fat Boy, and the Devil to his specification. And those, all those little sidebars were put together by Emily McCullough and Pete Robbins. And getting back to the front of the magazine, we're going to go back to State and finish up our show today with Meanwhile in Texas, because it hits close to home in my hometown of Richardson. A 10-year-old girl woke up one morning to find a raccoon calmly sitting next to her in bed. 9 Gregg County jail employees resigned after it was revealed that they were watching movies on the job the night an inmate successfully escaped. A sophomore at Axtell High School near Waco bought all his female classmates flowers for Valentine's Day. A Dallas exotic dancer who fractured her jaw when she fell 15 feet while performing a routine on a pole decided to give up her job and enroll in esthetician school. A rare pink grasshopper, its color is the result of an uncommon genetic mutation, was spotted in Travis County. Kmart announced that its shop in McAllen, the last Kmart in Texas, would close for good. During the Texas primary, Democratic voters in the state's 27th congressional district nominated a San Diego resident who simultaneously ran unsuccessfully for the Democratic nomination for congressional seat in California, a race in which his father was running, also unsuccessfully, for the Republican nomination. A man suspected of flashing people at a Whataburger in Houston was killed after he was hit by a car while running from the police. A Port Arthur man was sentenced to 30 days in jail and fined $1,000 after he posted a video of himself at a Walmart opening a container of Bluebell ice cream and licking the contents, though he claimed that he immediately purchased the item. And a man was arrested for burning down a statue of a grackle outside of Austin's City Hall. And this was all put together by Leif Reigstad, and about out of easily finished material today. We don't want to get something started that we can't finish. So that brings us to the end of our reading for today.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by audiobook news at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Midland County Public Library reopened on Wednesday while taking extra precautions for the safety of patrons and staff. In accordance with Governor Greg Abbott's guidelines, occupancy will be limited to 25% capacity. Both branches will open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The first hour of each day, 10 to 11 a.m., is reserved for high-risk patrons, including those who are 65 and older, and children 5 and younger accompanied by an adult. All types of materials are available for checkout, and patrons will have access to free Wi-Fi and public computers. To minimize contact, circulation desks will offer only self-checkout, and services such as printing, copying, faxing, and notaries will not be available. Meeting and study rooms are not open for reservations. High-touch areas will be cleaned every 2 hours. Curbside service will be available at the downtown branch only.
Texans have always connected over shared stories, and that's more important than ever right now. During this time, as reading services have a reduced number of readers, many of the national publications we air are not being produced. Thankfully, some of our local volunteers have agreed to take on additional reading for a locally produced substitute program, Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, we'll read features and columns from past editions of the Magazine of Texas. Some of these articles date back to the 1970s and 80s. You'll hear articles about Texas sports figures, musical artists, stories related to the Permian Basin, and more. We hope that these shows will keep you entertained and jog a memory or two. Texas Monthly Archives can be heard Thursday mornings at 10, Thursday nights at 7, and Friday mornings at 5, with additional airings throughout the week as the need arises. Texas Monthly Archives, from Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 88 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then tomorrow, mostly sunny and hot with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch, continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg. While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark, revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From the Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas, with more than 7,000 azalea bushes along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize Garden is transformed in another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare Hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden hosts other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA Garden Director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused, unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA's school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See, timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general, mid-March through early April, you should be able to enjoy the beauty of these gardens. If you come later, you may see many of the Satsuki varieties, which bloom in late April and into early June, depending on the variety, and the popular Encore series and other reblooming azaleas that produce a second wave of colorful blooms later in the year. The Disappeared Man Who Loved Azaleas by William Scheich. The luxurious blooms of Hoang azalea hybrids hide a sad story about their corrector, T. Lin Hoang. This historically obscure man lived in China where he bred numerous varieties of his beloved plant. during his homeland's Cultural Revolution between 1966 and 1976, Hwang was abruptly uprooted from his private, azalea-strewn Shangri-La. Along with countless others, Hwang was forced to labor on collective farms, where his life was plowed under by history. Ruined, too, were his extensive azalea collections and the meticulous records he kept about their breeding. Even so, Hwang's spirit lived on in some of his hybrids surviving at the Shanghai Botanical Garden. Rooted cuttings from these azaleas